Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavit Akhlai. The Kremlin warned that any expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine would cross one of President Vladimir Putin's red lines. What are Putin's red lines, especially when it comes to Ukraine? Meanwhile, Belarus has said that it had agreed to take action with Moscow to counter growing NATO activity. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether Ukraine is brewing to be a flashpoint again between Russia and the U.S., and what Russia will do now that one of its red lines has been crossed.
Russia has warned NATO against setting up military infrastructure in Ukraine. It comes after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the United States is creating military bases in Ukraine under the guise of establishing training centers. Lukashenko said he has discussed the issue with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and they agreed to take action to counter the growing NATO activity.
It's actions that will provide for the strategic interests and security of our two allied states. The issue of potential expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was numerously mentioned by President Putin, and President Putin said it was beyond a red line he had talked about repeatedly.
Moscow has time and again warned against NATO's expansion in Ukraine, saying it is a red line the West will regret crossing. Last week, Russia held large-scale joint military drills with Belarus. The maneuvers followed Ukraine's joint war games with the U.S. and other NATO member states. Tensions have been simmering between Moscow and Kiev since the ouster of Ukraine's elected president Viktor Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed revolt in 2014. The tensions further escalated after Crimea declared autonomy from Ukraine to reunite with the Russian Federation. The so-called revolution in Ukraine and Kiev's subsequent reach out to NATO could be part of a puzzle being pieced together by the United States and its allies to contain Russia militarily.
Well, joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have the Executive Vice President of Eurasia Center, Earl Rasmussen, who joins us from Minneapolis. Also, radio host and political analyst Tim Kirby, who joins us from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Tim Kirby, let me first start with you. You have a warning coming from the Kremlin that any expansion of NATO military infrastructure, as it has been termed, in Ukraine would cross one of Vladimir Putin's red lines. First, what NATO infrastructure is he referring to? I'm sure it's not just a couple guns.
No, what they're referring to is the possibility that essentially, especially the U.S. or NATO as a whole, is trying to preemptively build bases before Ukraine would be to join NATO. However, we should go back a few years in time. The leadership of the breakaway republics out east in the Donbass both claimed that whereas NATO says they've offered basically soldiers to train the locals to protect themselves, The breakaway republics consider them to be mercenaries and believe that the concept of this training process has been used to masquerade different operations, especially by mercenaries.
Okay, just rewind a little bit here. When you say mercenaries, can you expand a little bit more for us on that?
Well, judging by some of the, let's just say, not so fortunate people who have, especially Polish or other Eastern European citizenship, you know, the United States, Poland, Germany, Where else have they found people from? Thinking possibly Romania. None of these countries have entered this war on an official capacity, but time and again you happen to find, or at least according to the Breakaway Republics, you happen to find a dead body with that particular identification on it. So there does seem to be, at least if you believe the Breakaway Republics' version of history, there does seem to be a mercenary, at the very least, influence. Perhaps those mercenaries are actually not so much in it for the money, and it's part of something covert. But again, proving that is quite difficult, so we shouldn't jump into conspiracy theories.
Sure. Well, Earl Rasmussen, Vladimir Putin is indicating that this is a red line. But it's plural. Tell us what the red lines of President Putin is. Obviously, as evident from the news, one of them is the fact that Moscow is under the impression that the U.S. is building military bases in Ukraine.
Yeah, I think obviously we know one of the red lines is inclusion of Ukraine into NATO. I personally do not see that happening, although there is a lot of political pressure to it. I don't think the Europeans would be supportive of that as well, because they know that would be dangerous. You can talk about expansion of NATO into Ukraine. You know, that's if you had actual military bases, that definitely would be in that area. I don't necessarily think that often we have, you know, training advisors, and you can put those in many different, you know, modes or interpretations of that across the world with many different places. And those definitely are not considered military bases. Now, could they be using that as a means to hide potential increased growth in military presence there? Absolutely. But from a purely training military advisory perspective, I don't necessarily see that as crossing into that red line. Getting close to it, but I don't necessarily see that in that zone area. I think Russia would continue to seek to find a diplomatic solution versus a military solution, and then maybe we'll get into that later. But the issues now and the growth of a presence, or even the military advisory presence and training presence, increases the potential likelihood of perhaps Ukraine doing something on their own, maybe with, you know, some type of approval, but definitely potentially on their own. That may escalate the situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's try to just break down this piece of news in all its different details here. Tim Kirby, Belarusian president, has warned of a joint response with Russia to this increased activity of NATO in Ukraine. Tell us why Belarus is involved here, and what type of joint response may it be referring to?
Well, why it's involved is because it would seem, according to the Belarusian president, that it wasn't that long ago that they tried to stage a color revolution against him, because we have to remember that despite the fact that maybe on the surface he seemed very loyal to Moscow, he's been playing a good game of balanced politics his entire career as president. Only recently, when he sort of refused to submit completely to the demands of the West, basically they tried to do the old good old color revolution, and that has sort of forced his hand to shove him closer to Moscow. So essentially, in the past, maybe when the Maidan revolution happened, when the first shots were fired in the Donbass, Belarus was much more neutral in many ways. In fact, that's why there were the Minsk Accords, because it was sort of in between the West and the East, and theoretically, it was a neutral territory. But now the interest of their secret service is very much focused on Ukraine. Another reason would be that the very same type of people, and in some instances, literally the exact same people who organized and executed the Maidan, were going up to Belarus to enact some sort of color revolution in Minsk. So there's a bit of a personal interest as well.
Okay, so do you agree with that, Earl Rasmussen, in terms of the involvement that Lukashenko has? Go ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree with that analysis. That you've got, I think there was pressure to probably move more over. Lukashenko has been doing the balancing act. And I think basically he was put in a situation, and the West was supportive and if not complicit completely, but they were definitely involved with supporting the demonstrations and potential color revolution in Ukraine, and basically pushed Lukashenko solidly more into alliance in the Russia camp. And, you know, they always probably favored that, but Lukashenko really was, as was, you know, our other guest mentioned, really trying to straddle and play an independent role and be in the middle there. But this has become now more of a personal issue with him as well. So I agree with that position there. We're creating the West actually helped create this situation and the closer ties with between Belarus and Russia as well.
Well, when Lukashenko was asked, Tim Kirby, about what kind of response, he said, first, we did agree with President Putin that some kind of measure needs to take place. And when digging deeper, he said, these need to be actions that ensure the security of the two of our states. What do you think he means by that?
I think it goes back to what I was saying, that a lot of the color revolutionaries came up from Kiev to go try to change things in Belarus. In fact, the sort of Belarusian opposition with their white and red flags has a very similar mentality to the Maidan Kiev sort of forces that won the battle of the streets in 2014. So in a way it is for him, for Lukashenko, for Belarus as a whole, it is really a matter of national security. But also when it comes to Russia, there are really only two issues that I think the public is really deeply unsatisfied with in terms of President Putin. Number one were the Social Security or pension reforms, depending on your terminology, which were very, very unpopular, let's say, and the handling of the situation in Ukraine. Ukraine is a very, very deep part of Russian history. Many would argue an inherent part, an inalienable part. And it's sort of like it's a real tragedy. For Russians, it's a real tragedy, and it's a tragedy so big that it actually in some ways causes an element of destabilization within the Russian system itself.
You mentioned Earl Rasmussen about Ukraine's, I guess, previous perhaps inclination to want to join NATO, and how Russia obviously has vehemently opposed that. Tell us why, and this has been said a number of times in the past years, tell us why that is not something that has happened, why it has there not been enough of a motion forward, either from Ukraine or from NATO, perhaps, for Ukraine to join it.
Well, I think, I think the population in Ukraine is against it. I don't think you have maybe marginally for it, but for the most part against it. I think they see them as, and in reality, Ukraine would be used as a ploy, a playground in the middle of between any type of potential conflict. Really, there's no benefit for NATO to expand other than further kind of isolate Russia for some reason, and I don't think it's good. It just is a poor decision on that side. Plus, if you look at the elections in Ukraine over history, you had the color revolution, the orange revolution, then you had the movement towards, and you had Lukashenko come into office later on. So you really got a political division there. You've got to the east to more favor Russian, to the west, you've got aspects of historically from Poland and Romania and Czech involved there. So there's a whole different, really have a different culture in Ukraine. It's made up of multiple different cultures. I think on a total perspective, most people would not wish there's not a conflict. Most people would not want to be part of NATO. And most would like to have a peaceful, in both from a military perspective and from an economic perspective, relationship with Russia. Ukraine really has a good potential, at least did at one time, being a bridge between that. But unfortunately, that has probably been put off for a long time, if ever, to reestablish itself. But I think that I don't think the popular support would be behind a not only the issue with Russia being against it, but I don't think the popular support in Ukraine, and I don't think the Europeans, the other Europeans would be, especially Germany and France, would be very excited about Ukraine's potential inclusion into the formal NATO structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tim Kirby, this is where I'd like to find out who's pushing whom into this scenario. And I'm talking in particular about NATO and the U.S. And I'm going to come at you with this fact, that the U.S. spends more on this NATO budget, from what we understand, than all of the rest of the NATO members combined, estimated to be about $730 billion. That's according to the U.K. Defense Journal. So given that, is the U.S. pushing NATO in its confrontation with Russia using Ukraine, or is NATO acting on its own? Because it seems that the U.S. is the one making decisions here in one respect.
Well, in terms of NATO, not just related to Russia, but generally overall, the real moving force behind that is obviously the United States. I mean, if you look at the composition of NATO, maybe you could make an argument that England and France, which are both nuclear-armed and do have some military potential, may matter. But the overwhelming majority members are just absolutely pathetic. And even Donald Trump himself tried to actually force these people to pay up, to pay their 2% of GDP like they promised, because for years they wouldn't. And America was really footing the bill for all of that. So NATO is really an extension of America. Does it serve the interests of Europe, especially Western Europe? That's up to the viewer to decide. That's a bit of an emotional argument there on either side. But yeah, America is the driving force. And one of the key issues written when the Project for New American Century was written was that you cannot allow a new power to rise. And that ties into the somewhat already cliche musings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who said that Russia will never become a great power or empire, I forget the wording, without having the Ukraine as part of it. So if his prophecy is to be believed, which there's a lot of logic to, Washington definitely does not want Russia to unite with its historic homeland.
Mm-hmm. Earl Rasmussen, you mentioned about the fact that there are some European countries, perhaps we can mention Germany, at least the signals coming from Merkel, that really do want to have a relationship with Russia. Maybe you can tell us what other European countries do want that. But
I would say obviously Germany, and there's, you know, both my contacts in Russia as well as Germany really have pro positive viewpoints of each other, you know, especially within the business community. And I think France, too. I think France would like to have increased business relationships, economic relationships with Russia. I think also if you look at probably Italy, Greece, two other ones, Spain potentially as well. So it really, there is a lot. And they see a lot of potential economic cooperation, which is beneficial to them, and especially in this current environment. And we're looking at increased economic growth. Germany obviously is potentially, you know, primed to be a major energy hub, thanks to Nord Stream 2 once that completed and is online, and we've already seen energy shortages. So this is Russia's a easy access from both natural resources, but also from a trade and technology market as well. It's a positive win-win situation if we've got improved economic ties between Russia and Germany, France, and other European countries.
Tim Kirby, a certain incident happened recently, and I'm wondering if this is going to actually affect the way that NATO countries can unite or will be united against Russia, because as one headline said, it appears that it's not going to be the case. NATO countries pondering alliance without Washington. Just one of the headlines.
Yeah.
And this came after the debacle, as some say, over that AUKUS incident, that trilateral security pact between Australia, the UK, and the US. Obviously, France very ticked off about that. Are we looking at perhaps fissures there and distance between countries with the US so as to not follow the U.S. lead when it comes to Russia?
Well, in some ways, if it is true that the U.S. is in decline, it's possible to believe that trying to maintain and hold the NATO that keeps the somewhat arguably valueless Western European continental mainland under control might not really actually be that worth it going into the future. This could be the fact that I live in Russia, but there is a great amount of optimism towards this AUKUS move. For a lot of people in Russia, it's a signal that perhaps America and England are going to be more focused on sort of an Anglo-Saxon world rather than trying to dominate the European continent. Because as mentioned by our other colleague earlier, there is a great desire for many in continental Europe to make better business ties, especially with Russia. And the only reason that there aren't as many is simply the artificial need to enforce sanctions over a peninsula that no one cares about outside of Ukraine and Russia.
All right, a final question to you, Earl Rasmussen. Do you see what is happening between Ukraine and Russia going to the next level where there will be a military phase involved?
I would hope not. I think it's dangerous because of the most recent with additional aid and the rhetoric that goes on. I kind of agree with Mr. Peskov that there may be some unintentional. There may be, Ukraine may feel emboldened and kind of take it to on their own, thinking they'll be supported to do some type of military settlement rather than fulfilling the Minsk Accords, and that's that would be unfortunate. I think it would create a very, very bad situation, and I would hope the European allies maintain some control on Ukraine from stepping in that direction. But that's a dangerous area, and I would hope it doesn't escalate to that, but it could it potentially could to some degree, but I think Russia would rightfully put a stop to that very quickly if those military actions happen and could rapidly deploy forces to that. But I would hope we don't get to that direction and hope the West kind of controls Zelensky and crew.
All right, very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guests, Executive Vice President of Eurasia Center, Earl Rasmussen from Minneapolis. Thank you. And radio host and political analyst Tim Kirby. A pleasure. Spoke to us from Moscow. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitapoy and the team, this is goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أفلا تعقلون.
And it is he who gives life and causes death, and his is the alternation of the night and the day. Then will you not reason?
As you have been previously with us, dear listeners, you already know that we were talking about the 80th verse of the chapter. وهو الذي يحيي ويميت. And he it is who gives life and death. وَلَهُ اخْتِلَافُ اللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ And unto him belongs the alteration of night and the day. أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ Have you then no sense? So, the ending part of the verse was here to tell us that all the factors and mercies of the Almighty Allah mentioned in the previous verses as well as in this verse are serving to guide us to knowing and thanking the Almighty Allah. So, at the end it says, أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ Have you no sense? The Holy Prophet وسلم, on the importance of intellect has said, Intellect is something by which paradise will be detained and through which the pleasure of Almighty Allah is achieved. As the words of the infallible Imams read, we understand that by means of intellect, we can achieve that by means of intellect, we can achieve both the goodness and reward of this world and hereafter. And it is reflected in our traditions that the one who has no intellect is deprived of the benefits and advantages of them altogether. Imam Ridha alayhi salam has said, "The intellect is the friend of every man, and his enemy is his ignorance." One cannot overcome the world except by the power of intellect. And that's the reason the Almighty Allah starts naming different mercies from his side. And at the end he says, أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ In this regard, the Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, Everything has a tool and support, and the believer's tool and support is the intellect. Everything has a vehicle, and man's vehicle is intellect.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أنتم الخلق
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Brothers and sisters, it seems that the Holy Prophet ﷺ is telling us that what drives us, what pushes us forward in our life, both in this world and hereafter, is the intellect. So we should learn how to use it. The Prophet ﷺ continues, "Everything has an end, and the end of worship is intellect." It seems that only through intellect we can achieve the highest station of mercy, close to the Almighty Allah. The Holy Prophet says, "Every nation has a guardian, and the guardian of worshippers is the intellect." The Holy Prophet says that we should be thoughtful of what transactions our community has, with which communities we have relationships, and which communities and which societies do we hold as hostilities. The Holy Prophet says, "Every merchant has a capital, and the capital of the strivers is the intellect. Every ruined is mended by something, and the hereafter is mended by the intellect. And every traveler has a tent in which he takes refuge, and the tent of the Muslim is his intellect." Brothers and sisters, we have many traditions upon the importance of intellect, and that the true Muslim has to use this mercy of the Almighty Allah in order to reach Him. And that is when he can use the mercies that the Almighty Allah has given him, the mercies previously mentioned. وَالَّذِي أَنْشَأَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ. He is the one who produced for you hearing, eyes and hearts. وَهُوَ الَّذِي ذَرَأَكُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ. He multiplied you in the earth. These were all mentioned in the previous verses by saying قَلِيلًا مَا تَشْكُرُونَ, very little of you give thanks. But afterwards, the Almighty Allah said that you shall be mustered unto Him, and at the end, أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ, which means that all of the previously mentioned mercies were here to tell us that we must have intellect. Otherwise, we shall be punished, and the chastisement of the unbelievers awaits us as well. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when faith begins?
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As Afghans witness their most difficult days amid the collapse of government and newly settlement of Taliban's emirate, Islamic Republic of Iran delivers its third round of medical and food aids to Afghanistan. This Iranian plane carrying humanitarian aid arrived at Kabul airport on Saturday, containing several tons of rice and other basic food products.
The plane that you see here has brought Iranian aids containing 15 tons of food products. We are here to sort out the aid supplies. We thank neighboring countries that help us in this critical situation and stand by our side after the withdrawal of the U.S. forces.
Due to bazaar shortage and increasing prices of food and medical goods, Afghans in major cities and villages demand humanitarian aids. Furthermore, they're concerned about their assets being frozen by the U.S.
We are in a critical situation. Public assets, including our salaries, have been blocked and most of us have lost our jobs. We demand neighboring countries to provide us with humanitarian aid.
Afghanistan's economy, which depends on foreign aid, suffered a big loss in the recent change of government. The people of Afghanistan look forward to receiving international aid, calling for an end to sanctions on Afghanistan as soon as possible. They believe that blocking the assets of Afghans by U.S. government puts the people under pressure rather than the Taliban.
The United Nations has warned of a looming food crisis in Afghanistan. The UN has also said that its food stocks in the country could run out by the end of September, further pushing millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A number of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers during military raids into different areas in Jenin and northwest of Al-Quds. Three Palestinians were killed near the towns of Beit Anan and Biddu northwest of Al-Quds. The Israeli military said its forces had been tracking a Hamas movement cell for several days and had conducted a wave of operations against the movement across the West Bank and killed Ahmad Zahran, Mahmoud Ahmedan, and Zakaria Badwan, all from Biddu town.
We were shocked by the martyrdom of a number of our sons. We say their blood will pave the way for the Palestinians to go ahead with their fight against the occupation. This is only one part of the Zionist violation against our people.
In the village of Burqin, southwest of Jenin, 16-year-old Yusuf Sabah was killed during the clashes and his body was confiscated by the Israeli forces. 22-year-old Osama Subh was another Palestinian from Burqin killed by Israeli forces. He succumbed to his injuries in a hospital in the city. Palestinian Islamic Jihad later endorsed him as a group member and threatened that black days await Israel in the West Bank and its crimes will only intensify the movement's resistance and unity. Thousands took part in his funeral procession. His wedding was planned for next month, his father told us.
We received the news with utter shock and immense sadness, but no objection. It's Allah's will. Osama's wedding was supposed to be next month, but he was chosen to be martyred.
Two Israeli soldiers were seriously injured during the clashes that broke out between Palestinians and Israeli forces. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issued a statement backing the military's operation.
Palestinians say Israel uses lethal force to stem anti-regime resistance in the occupied territories. But they say Tel Aviv will fail to intimidate them into giving up their struggle. Muna Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
September 26 marks the International Day of Solidarity with Palestinian Journalists, initially declared by the International Federation of Journalists in 1996.
To this end, Palestinians held a sit-in rally in front of the house of the journalist Youssef Abu Hussein, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes during the last escalation in the Gaza Strip.
Youssef has been targeted inside his home. Israeli regime intends to target journalists in an attempt to hide the truth of this inhuman regime from being delivered to the world. This is totally against international law to target civilians.
There are 24 Palestinian journalists inside Israeli jails, including a female journalist. There are also a huge number of journalists that were injured and others killed while doing their work.
Palestinian journalists and media outlets have always been a direct target of the Israeli regime. Hundreds of journalists have been killed or injured while covering the Israeli crimes in Gaza.
This is a stand to express our support and loyalty to our colleagues who have been killed or arrested by the Israeli regime for only covering the truth. This event is held to highlight that we won't allow the international community to ignore the Israeli crimes committed against journalists. During the last escalation, we lost Youssef. 35 media institutions were bombed and more than 12 journalists were injured.
Palestinians called on the international media organizations to show solidarity with Palestinian journalists and take steps to provide them with security.
During the recent escalation of unrest in Gaza, the Israeli regime has intentionally targeted Palestinian journalists and destroyed several media offices in a bid to block the truth. Palestinians here call on the international community to provide protection and security for journalists and hold Israel accountable for committing atrocities against them. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
This is the second time that the aircraft that belongs to Iran's Mahan Airlines lands here in Kabul International Airport since the beginning of September to deliver tons of humanitarian aids to war-weary Afghans who are experiencing difficult days due to poverty and joblessness.
This is the second time that we have brought some food for the Afghani people. Before the previous time, it was about 25 pounds. 20 tons of food and 5 tons of medicine. This time it is all food.
The flow of humanitarian aid by Iran to Afghanistan is welcomed by all in Afghanistan, saying their country needs more assistance to save the lives of millions of ordinary people who are at risk of hunger and malnutrition. They also believe there must be a transparent process to distribute the aids to most needy ones.
Given that poverty and joblessness are on the rise in Afghanistan, I think it would be better for donors to first provide food and then pay serious attention to the healthcare sector.
We have been receiving international aid since 2001 during the rule of Karzai and Ghani over Afghanistan, but all to no avail, because poverty is still bothering our people. So my suggestion is that these aids must be distributed first among the most vulnerable, poor and jobless people.
Iran has pledged to continue its support to Afghanistan and its people in different economic, humanitarian, political and security fields. This comes as Taliban takeover in mid-August suddenly changed the situation in Afghanistan, and of course, it also brought some major changes in the policies of some Western states, mainly the U.S. toward Afghanistan, such as freezing Afghanistan's assets. The freeze of Afghanistan's reserves by the U.S. is labeled as an illegal move by Washington against ordinary people. That is why Afghans widely condemn the move and ask why ordinary Afghans should pay the price of Washington's defeat in Afghanistan. However, Afghans look to supportive stances and moves of some neighboring countries like Iran as an example of honesty and true cooperation with Afghans. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Britain is witnessing long queues outside fuel stations, including the capital London, following fuel rationing at some distribution centers and temporary closure of many retail stations. British Petroleum said it has closed more than 1,000 of its fuel distribution stations, citing a lack of both unleaded and diesel grades. The multinational gas and oil company blame the closure on a shortage of truck drivers. The government has cautioned against panic buying, saying there's no shortage at refineries. Britons have, however, paid little heed to the pledge, as long queues of motorists have been forming outside filling stations since Saturday morning. Retailers have warned that the clock is ticking for the government and that it only had just days to prevent a significant disruption in festive preparations in the run-up to Christmas, which is only 3 months away. The administration of Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that it's looking at temporary measures to address the issue. British media say the government is mulling allowing some 5,000 truckers into Britain on short-term work visas in a bid to alleviate the acute labor shortage. The UK's Road Haulage Association, however, says Britain needs 100,000 drivers to meet the demand. The UK opposition leader has blasted the government for what he called letting the people down amid the fuel crisis.
We're obviously at a crucial time for the country, and this government is letting people down so badly, whether it's hammering working people on tax and universal credit, whether it's shortages of food and fuel. I've just been up the road, three petrol stations, one of them with a massive queue and two of them with no fuel.
The driver shortage is partly blamed on Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, which has resulted in tens of thousands of truckers from EU member states leaving the UK. But it has been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. The shortage has also set Britain on path for food chaos, since it has led to disruption in deliveries to supermarkets and fast food chains. The fuel issue comes as Britain is also facing a record high surge in natural gas prices, with wholesale prices being up to 250% since January. Experts say households will get hit by surging power bills this coming winter, while small energy firms are at risk of collapsing. Supermarkets and food firms say the price rise has caused a shortage of carbon dioxide, which is threatening UK supplies of meat and fresh produce.
The United States border with Mexico has witnessed an influx of asylum seekers in recent weeks, with thousands, mostly Haitians, massing there after fleeing poverty in their home country. The migrants reached the Rio Grande after a long, treacherous journey. Images showed people with toddlers staying in squalid tents under a bridge in the Texan border town of Del Rio. But as usual, U.S. authorities began removing and expelling and in some cases cracking down on refugees despite criticism at home and abroad. On Thursday, U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigned in a fiery letter over what he called inhumane expulsions of asylum seekers. The United Nations also demanded an end to the mass expulsion, with UN Refugee Chief calling it inconsistent with international norms. The United Nations Human Rights Office particularly expressed concern over the ill treatment of migrants at the southern U.S. border.
Like, we are disturbed by the images we've seen and by the fact that we've seen all these migrants and refugees and asylum seekers being transported to Port-au-Prince. We are seriously concerned by the fact that it appears that there has not been any individual assessment on the case.
Condemnations poured in after images showing predominantly white federal agents on horseback whipping and chasing migrants went viral on social media. Human rights groups say such incidents are reminiscent of the disturbing U.S. history of racial and ethnic violence.
The United States has been in existence. It has exploited African people, no matter where African people have been dispersed around the world by Europeans.
The Mexican president, whose country has been the main transit for U.S.-bound migrants, called on his American counterpart to deal with the root cause of the migrant problem. Andrés Manuel López Obrador urged the U.S. to invest in the countries from where migration originates. As the U.S. continues to grapple with the influx of migrants, it remains to be seen whether the Biden administration prevents the crisis on its southern border in a humane way or continues breaking its promises to welcome migrants into the country.
Nerves are growing more frayed in the EU ahead of winter time.
Gas prices have soared by 250% since the start of the year, and supplies are depleting. Almost half of all gas used in the EU is imported from Russia, but relations between the bloc and Moscow are at an all-time low. Analysts say it's not surprising, therefore, that the Kremlin is reluctant to increase supplies. The crisis has been discussed at a meeting of EU energy ministers attended by senior European Commission officials.
We have to end our dependence on foreign, volatile fossil fuels as soon as possible. We also need to take energy efficiency seriously.
Experts say ordinary, hard-pressed citizens are now paying the price because the EU refuses to dial down its anti-Russia rhetoric.
It's not possible to expect that European Union will export its rules, its behavior, all its values to everybody in this neighborhood. But it seems to me that the feeling here sometimes in the political bodies of the European Union is the following. If others are not taking the internal rules of the European Union, that does mean that they are wrong, that they are incorrect.
Gas prices have shot up due to demand because economies are bouncing back from the pandemic. In the EU, last winter and spring were colder than usual, and so gas reserves in the 27-nation bloc were hit. Since then, power grids have not benefited much from wind energy due to mild weather conditions. Moscow and Berlin want the speedy approval of Nord Stream 2, the controversial pipeline under the Baltic Sea that will double Russian gas exports to Germany. Completed earlier this month, the pipeline cannot start delivering gas until it clears regulatory hurdles here in the European Commission. The United States is very much against the Russian-German gas pipeline, and analysts say Washington is putting the EU under pressure to try and delay things. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Millions of energy customers face spiraling price hikes as several smaller firms in the market have collapsed in a matter of days. Avro Energy and Green ceased trading on Wednesday, with existing customers now face being put onto expensive new tariffs, with the energy regulator warning there could be more bad news ahead.
Not unusual for suppliers to go out of the market. I think what's different this time is that dramatic change in the costs that those suppliers are facing. So we've had around sort of, you know, had five roughly over the past few months. We've had a number more at the start of the year.
Business Minister Kwasi Kwarteng has already said there will be no bailout for the majority of energy firms, but the government will instead focus on the plight of the customer.
The government has been clear that protecting consumers is our primary focus and shapes our entire approach to this issue. We will continue to protect consumers with the energy price cap.
On the streets of the British capital, there were fears of what a price hike would mean, but also calls for accountability.
It's unacceptable. Everything is going high, even the price of food and everything is going high. Even the public transport, everything is going high. So the government, they should do something about that.
Are you worried that your bills might increase this winter?
Yes, I am. I'm a pensioner. I'm very worried about it.
At some point, there has to be a reason as to why this has happened, whether it could have been foreseen, whether things could have been done to prevent it. The people who run the energy companies, how much money have they made? How much money have they taken off and shipped offshore? That should be looked at.
The British consumer has had a tough couple of months. First of all, dealing with the uncertainty around Brexit, the fallout from the COVID crisis, and now the prospect of spiraling energy costs.
Once more, it will be the most vulnerable who may yet again bear the brunt of any drastic price hikes this winter, with some households having to choose between heating and eating. Amina Taylor, London.
Former Catalan regional leader Carles Puigdemont must stay in Sardinia, Sassari judge ruled on Friday. The politician had been arrested by the Italian police upon his arrival to the Sardinian town of Alghero on Thursday night. Puigdemont had reportedly travelled there to attend a conference, but he was put in custody as soon as he stepped onto Italian soil. he was detained under an international arrest warrant issued by Spain over his alleged involvement in the unilateral independence referendum and the subsequent unilateral declaration of independence of Catalonia 4 years ago. Puigdemont is now a member of the European Parliament living in Belgium. Tens of supporters of the politician demonstrated outside the Sassari court calling for his release.
Later on Friday, former Catalonia president Puigdemont was released by a local court, but the politician will have to remain in Sardinia until questions such the validity of the European arrest warrant against him and his immunity status are resolved. Should the arrest be considered valid, the same court will have to decide whether to hand him over the Spanish authorities.
Italy's Justice Ministry on its side has made clear it had played no role in the case, which, quote, was the sole preserve of the judges involved. Max Civili, Rome.
Islamic and national factions in the Gaza Strip held a protest in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who are under hunger strike and are subjected to Israeli abuse. The event that included Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross headquarters came a day after an ex-prisoner, Hussein Masalma, died of cancer after being detained for 19 years.
We are here in front of the Red Cross to remind the international human rights organizations of their role to protect our prisoners inside Israeli jails and who are under solitary confinement. There are six prisoners under hunger strike protesting the inhumane Israeli abuse against them and the illegal administrative detention. This is not the only medical negligence of hundreds of our prisoners, but an international killing practiced by the Israeli regime.
Al-Masalma's medical condition deteriorated due to complications resulting from Israeli medical negligence and torture at the time he was in custody that led to his inevitable slow death.
There is no doubt that Palestinian detainees are witnessing tough measures and abuse inside the Israeli jails, especially following the escape operation. Yesterday, Al-Masalma succumbed to his cancer that deteriorated while being in jail. There are more than hundreds of inmates who have lost their lives in Israeli jails due to intentional medical negligence.
Palestinian factions say they won't sit idle while Israeli violations against the prisoners are increasing, urging the international community to take serious action to save the prisoners' life.
We are holding Friday prayer here in front of the Red Cross to express our support to our prisoners who are a symbol of our Palestinian cause. We will always be proud of their patience. Our message to the Israeli regime is clear. We hold Israel responsible for the lives of our prisoners and we won't remain silent over these violations.
Palestinian detainees are passing through hard medical conditions as 15 inmates inside Israeli jails are diagnosed with cancer, while more than 200 others have lost their lives as a result of the Israeli systematic policy of medical negligence.
While hundreds of Palestinian detainees, including women and children, are subjected to inhumane violations of their rights inside Israeli jails, Palestinians here are paying efforts, demanding the international community to break its silence over the prisoners'